Welcome to Faith and Family. I'm Andy Bates. When you are online, what are... We talked about security of your home computer recently, but how secure is your heart, your mind, particularly that of your children? What are the threats and what can we find on the internet, or what finds us oftentimes on the internet? And particularly, how does that pertain to our children? How do we care for our children, protect them in this, well, virtually a public square that sometimes takes us into places that aren't so public, but publicly accessible? We're going to learn more about that with our friends from Covenant Eyes in just a moment here on Faith and Family. Thanks to our underwriter, Concordia University, Wisconsin, for supporting Faith and Family. You find them in the sponsor section on KFUO.org. Look for Concordia University, Wisconsin. Joining me by phone this morning, Chris McKenna of Covenant Eyes, covenanteyes.org. Chris, welcome to Faith and Family.
Good morning. Hi, Andy. Thank you.
Glad to have you with us this morning. And interested to learn a little bit more about your work with Covenant Eyes and why you became a part of that organization.
Sure, yeah. I'm the educational resource manager there, and so I work in the marketing department to make sure that we educate as many individuals, whether they're users of our service or not, on how to use tools to avoid internet temptation. That was what we were founded on by Rhonda Haas, our president, 16 years ago, knowing that the internet was going to become, even at that time, he foresaw it becoming an ever-present danger and a risk to raising children. And so that really became sort of his driving motivation to create a service that would help parents do that. And as somebody who is raising four young digital natives, as a dad who is a digital immigrant, I find great comfort in tools like Covenant Eyes and helping to teach, in this case, my oldest daughter, who's the only one with a smart device, how to use technology well. And just find that personally I align very much with their goals, having come from my own sort of internet safety background, and about a year ago, having joined forces with Covenant Eyes in order to help as many people as possible use technology well.
Would we have even thought of internet safety, the safety of our children on the internet? We couldn't have even thought of this, 30 years ago. When you were thinking about your future career, would these topics have even, as a youth, would these topics have even crossed your mind as how important it is to protect our children, the safety of children when it comes to this thing we call the internet?
Well, no, not, I mean, right? I mean, and mosquito predators, I mean, these are Old Testament issues, and it, hard. We can find examples of the problem in issues and accelerate like gasoline. Internet makes all of these things affordable, accessible, and infamous in many cases, and all of those things fuel inappropriate human behavior. And so they're old at having new accessibility and new twist. So
Chris, let's pause there for just a moment. We're missing some of what you're saying. Our connection is fading a little bit there as we're talking. So let's go back and recap a little bit more of that as you're talking about the internet and this generation and you mentioned that these are Old Testament issues. Let's revisit that.
Yeah, these are things that I think we could point to that existed even when we were children. Right when I was in middle school or back in the 80s, there were predators, there was pornography, there were bullies, but it's the internet that acts as gasoline or accelerant for old issues so that they are immensely more accessible and they never turn off in some cases, whereby if I was being bullied, let's say, once I got off the bus, home was safe. Unless they called and I picked up the phone, I was safe. There are no more safe places for kids from these issues. The internet makes that possible.
Because the internet has become incorporated into our lives in a number of ways. So That's a question I think we'll get to here in just a few minutes of what do we do as parents about where we incorporate internet and social media and access to these things in our lives, in our homes. You mentioned, you know, pornography has been an issue for much of our lives. Would you say that pornography has become a normalized part of adolescent life for American youth today?
Yes, and the statistics support that, knowing that when I was a kid, really all my parents needed to know in order to protect me from sexualized content was, did the house where I was spending the night have Showtime, Cinemax, or HBO? And that was kind of the greatest risk. And, you know, a lot of people can laugh at that because they can relate to, oh, yeah, you know what I'm talking about. But these devices that are in their hands, and I want to step back for just a minute and say, I believe the internet is a great thing. And this is what I teach kids and parents all the time. I'm not here to demonize technology. Technology is a fabulous tool that can be used to evangelize and reach the world in ways that we never dreamed possible. But we just need to be careful, because the difference between, and I say this to parents and kids, the difference between the good spot and the bad spot is now just one click. It didn't used to be that razor thin when I was a kid. Like, the difference between good spots and bad spots were pretty discernible, and there were some distance either physically or some relationally away. That's just not the case anymore. That one click separates those places, and that's the danger. Is even good, God-honoring Christian kids can make one bad click.
And not even necessarily intentionally. They, you know, just one click, even almost, you know, innocently, accidentally, and end up in a place where they're facing something that's very dangerous and harmful.
That's right. This is somewhat cliche. You hear this a lot, but it's absolutely true that it's not a matter of if your child will see something inappropriate. It's only a matter of when. And so in teaching parents, what I tell them is that kids who do well in the digital age are kids who have the tools in their belt to know what to do when they see something inappropriate, because it will happen. I guarantee it will happen.
What are some of the numbers concerning the percentage of children and youth exposed to pornography? Like, what has become the most common age at which children are first exposed to pornography in some form?
Yeah, you know, there's ranges of figures that I'm fairly comfortable giving, because it's hard to, every study is going to show a slightly different number, but I say it's fairly safe to say that sometime between age 9 and 12, most children will have accidentally, intentionally, or shown by a friend out of curiosity, some form of inappropriate content online. So I'm very comfortable using that range, 9 to 12, for that first exposure. Some studies will point to the low end of that range and the 9, others will point a little bit higher, but that's a fairly safe range to say, which really puts the onus on parents to start having conversations much earlier than they're probably comfortable having them.
What does this say about the attitudes of children and youth regarding pornography? We mentioned just a little bit ago, this is really becoming a normalized part of adolescent life for American youth. What does this say about their attitudes toward pornography and material that's inappropriate and even harmful?
I don't think this is a good parent. What's your issue? Do you do? My daughter, or my kids, they don't.
Chris, we're still losing our connection with you here. Can you repeat that for us?
Is this better, Andy?
Yeah, that's a little bit better.
Okay. That it really just requires us to parent differently, more directly, and to really look our kids in the eyes and have honest, direct conversation with them all the time, not allow them to use social media when the world says they should, and push against some of those cultural pressures that require us to parent differently than many parents are currently parenting their children in the digital age.
So how has, you mentioned earlier, it's just one click away. How has the internet made pornography so much more accessible than, say, with our generation, you know, one or two generations back? It's just for parents who perhaps have not encountered it or not familiar with how accessible it is, paint a picture for us of how easily accessible it is, even for someone not intending to encounter internet pornography on the internet.
Well, by some estimates, and this is a really hard number to quantify, you know, there are well over a billion websites that exist, and it would be fairly accurate to assume that at least a fifth of those are pornographic in some way, right? And so translate this into our generation, right? If you put unfiltered internet access into your child's hand, meaning a smartphone that maybe out of motivation you gave it to them because you wanted to connect with them after soccer practice or something, but not appreciating the fact that it's connected to the World Wide Web, that would be no different than my dad putting 10 magazines on the coffee table when I was a kid, and one or two of them, maybe three or four of them, being pornographic and just hoping that I don't look at the wrong one. Right? So the unfiltered internet, even as Christians, is something that we just don't need access to because of its constant availability. The internet has no ethic. It's not going to support the way that we think as believers. And so there's so much risk in bumping into inappropriate things. That's why we have to be in kids' business and constantly helping them use technology well, to filter it and to monitor it and to talk about it all the time, because if those three things aren't in play, they're just going to bump into stuff that we don't want them to see.
How have we shaped the attitudes and behaviors of children and youth? How have we, as a generation of Americans, but this is, I know this is not just an American issue, but how have we shaped their attitudes and behaviors regarding pornography, but I'm sure this, we shape their attitudes and behaviors on a number of things. What about concerning pornography?
I think the primary contributor, Andy, to kids, and these are some generalizations, so if you'll allow me the the freedom to make some generalizations, I think it's one of the primary contributors is just silence. You know, parents ask me often, okay, Chris, what is the right age to talk to my kid about pornography? And my response to them is, I don't know your kid, but I guarantee it's sooner than you're ready, and I guarantee they're ready before you are. If you wait until you're ready, then you've missed the opportunity. They've already seen it, and they've already tried to look for answers as to what it is without your loving, God-directed biblical guidance. So be the first one to say the word to your kid. Sit down with your 8 and 9-year-old child and tell them exactly what pornography is, and not why just it's bad, but point to God's good design for sex and intimacy, because just telling them it's wrong doesn't satisfy the why. And so we have to dive into awkward places with our kids, because if we don't, Dr. Google will. And Dr. Google is shaping way too many moral frameworks of children today because their parents are afraid to talk about awkward things.
So let's dig into that a little bit more. What is the harm of pornography, and how do you communicate that to children in a way that hinders them from going to look for it, but not traumatizing them?
Well, you know, we start very early on in talking to children about their bodies and private parts and, you know, protecting themselves in that way. I don't think it's that big of a leap to say to a child, you know what, in the same way, using age-appropriate language, you know, to sit down with my, you know, six-year-old, I have twin seven-year-old boys, and I had this conversation with my son when he was six, and I said, you know what, in the same way that dad has told you to protect, you know, your private parts and no one ever touches you there or anything else, if you ever on the tablet, when daddy's not with you, ever saw anything that made you uncomfortable or you saw somebody's private parts, you would tell me. I want you to tell me about it. Let's practice that right now. You're going to put it down. You're going to tell someone. And he was like, oh, yeah, okay, yeah. And we practiced that because I wanted him to know at a very early, I didn't say the word pornography to him, but as a six-year-old, he has a tool in his belt to know what to do if he sees something inappropriate. Now, when my daughter was nine, yes, I showed her. We sat down together. There was a really great video that actually the Church of Latter-day Saints puts together because they're very progressive in their thinking about educating children about pornography. We watched this video together, and then I talked to her about the word, and she knows exactly what to do when a kid on the bus or somewhere else says the word. I've removed all of the curiosity that the enemy pounds in on. When a kid is curious, the enemy is going to press in on that and potentially cause them to search in a place that I want them to find the answer. If I've said the word first, I've removed the enemy's power of curiosity from that word, and she knows what to do with it. And so instead of being afraid of those conversations, it actually equips and empowers kids to know what to do when and if they bump into it when you're not there. Does that make sense?
Sure. So kids are very curious. We have a three-year-old, and he's very curious and is always interested in what I'm doing or what mommy's doing, and always wants to know, or if we're working on the computer, wants to know what's going on there. He's always interested in and curious about everything, the world in which he's growing up in. He wants to know more about. So that makes sense. Kids are very curious people. And if
you can...
As you pointed out, kill that curiosity before the enemy builds up something that's inviting to a child or develops that curiosity even more and draws them into something that's harmful. If you can kill that curiosity before the enemy gets to them, then perhaps we're a step ahead.
Definitely. And they're made to be curious. It's not killing the curiosity because curiosity, it's bad. It's just that if I've given them a tool to know when I'm curious what the answer is, then the enemy has less control. Those things that we deal with out in the light just automatically have less control over us. And so silence, when it comes to technology, silence on awkward things often leads to sinful choices, because kids start to believe the lie, I'm not hurting anybody, nobody knows, right? And the enemy presses in on those things. But if you're just open and honest to say, you know what, not only is this bad, but this is the way God made us, this is the way God wants it to be, and it's because he loves us and it just works better this way, give them the antidote to the lie that technology often gives them, then you're in a better spot.
So whether it's technology or other children they interact with through school or other settings, others or even adults that they may interact with, having the conversation, being ahead of the game so that you can kill that curiosity with the appropriate terms before it even happens. Let's go back to your household rules for online activity. What are your suggestions for parents, or what do you practice in your household when it comes to online activity? You mentioned mobile devices earlier and the rules for your children regarding that. Let's talk about online activity for kids.
Yeah, so just for context for parents, I have a 12-year-old, twin 7-year-olds, and a 5-year-old. So girl, boy, boy, boy. And so there's When I talk to parents, I have a number of different strategies that I talk to them about. But a couple of the high-level things is no internet activity in the bedroom. There are four primary places where kids often misuse technology. I've written a blog post about it, but it's grandma and grandpa's house, buses, bedrooms, and sleepovers. Those are the four primary place for internet misuse. And so as a general practice, I'm teaching my 12-year-old daughter that her technology is, unless there is explicit, you know, approval from mom or dad, is not to be used in her bedroom. So much so that she has a Bluetooth speaker that she listens to music from through her device, which is limited to talk, text, and music and a couple of games. The phone sits outside of her bedroom door, and it plays music through the Bluetooth speaker in her bedroom so she can listen to music in her bedroom, but she knows the device has to stay outside of the bedroom door. So I'm just sort of teaching her that behavior so that she knows that that's a spot where we just don't want it. And mom and dad are modeling that. So a huge part of having guidelines is to have moms and dads model the behaviors they want in their kids. So my wife and I are also trying to keep technology out of our bedrooms. That means no Candy Crush at night or whatever it looks like. You know, if you're trying to teach your teenage son or daughter not to be on the phone while they're in their car, if they're learning to drive, then, and this is a hard one, then moms need to know that every time they pick up their kids from school, don't be on the phone. And that's what you often see. But you're modeling the behavior for your children that is inconsistent with what you actually want them to do when they grow up. And so we just need to be very aware of that. And that translates even into filters and so forth. So my daughter, on her Android device, which I said is just talk, text, music, and a couple of games, we have everything else locked down on it with Covenant Eyes app lock feature. And Covenant Eyes is on that, so it shows me once a week in a report what activity she has done on her Android device. It shows me the app she's used. And so when I get that report and she knows that I also use Covenant Eyes, again, I'm modeling that, I have an accountability partner. When I get that report about every 2 weeks, I'll say, hey, honey, I got your accountability report from Covenant Eyes. I show her what it looks like. I want her to know that I get it, that there's transparency and openness. There's nothing that she needs to hide. And I compliment her, like, good job. It looks like you're using your apps during this time of the day, and that's great. And so, I'm trying to teach her behaviors that I want her to carry into adulthood, that the way we use technology is something we do out in the open, out in the light, not in dark secret places, because that's where the enemy has control. Those are just a couple of things that we are doing in our home on a long list. Those are a couple of the highlights.
What about when they get to those teen years? You know, when they get to those teen years, whether the boys or girls, when do you start opening up and giving them more access, more freedom? How do you make those decisions as to what level of freedom or what level of access they should have on mobile devices or on a laptop or something like that?
Andy, every kid is different. My 15-year-old may. You know, if I have a 15-year-old daughter, I may have different rules for her than my 15-year-old son. And that's just the reality. When it comes to technology, you must individually assess your children. And so in talking to parents, there are typically 5 to 7 characteristics that I teach them about that can help them assess the internet readiness of their children in terms of look at their friend history, how they navigate their friendships in real life will tell you how they navigate their technology. Look at their heart condition, how confident are they about themselves? Can they answer basic questions about their identity in terms of good things that God has put inside of them? Because if they can't answer basic questions about who they are, then they will search for identity online, which means they shouldn't have social media yet. So there's all kinds of things. You know, are they a curious child? Are they a child that is typically disobedient? Like all of these attributes that a parent should use as a filter for determining whether or not my child is ready for certain types of technology in the exact same deliberate way that they probably taught their child how to ride a bike. I mean, imagine if parents were as intentional about giving their kids technology as they were teaching them how to ride a bicycle. I mean, think of holding the handlebars in the back of the seat and training wheels and grassy surfaces and helmets and knee pads and all these things just we do to do just to teach them how to ride a bicycle. But instead, we put a smartphone in their hands and taking them to the top of the tall minute one. And it doesn't work, and it certainly doesn't work with technology. So you have to assess each child and sometimes rules for different things.
We are We are just about out of time, Chris. I want to make sure that we can point our listeners to the resource that that you have written, Parenting the Internet Generation from Covenant Eyes. How can we find this and other resources from Covenant Eyes?
That's right. Yeah, so if you go to covenanteyes.com, you have a whole list of resources for parents that are going to help them out, whether it's my child is looking at home, parenting the generation, other things that help families in different questions. A great thing about Parenting the Internet Generation are the talking guides that we have in the back to actually lead parents through conversations that they may not be comfortable having. And so we just really want those to be a benefit to as many families as possible.
Chris McKenna, Covenant Eyes, thanks so much for being our guest today, helping us look at Parenting the Internet Generation.
Concordia University, Wisconsin, in Mequon overlooks a half mile of beautiful Lake Michigan shoreline. CUW campus is located 15 miles north of Milwaukee, with over 70 undergraduate majors, 28 graduate degree programs, and doctorate programs in pharmacy, physical therapy, occupational therapy, and nursing practice. CUW offers online learning and accelerated learning at one of 9 Wisconsin centers and one in St. Louis. Traditional or accelerated education, CUW has the program for you. CUW.edu.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, president of Life Issues Institute.
Maurice Dopes is a huge chain of abortion mills. They're the Planned Parenthood of Europe and elsewhere. Recently, a British publication, the Daily Mail, published explosive revelations about how Maurice Dopes practices what one of their abortionists calls conveyor belt services. Law requires certain conditions be met before an abortion can be approved. But the reporter's investigation showed abortions were approved after brief phone conversations as short as 22 seconds. Thousands of abortions are approved on women doctors haven't even met. One abortionist signed dozens of consent forms in a mere 2 minutes. You know, this had to be a bad situation for the mainstream media to report on it. Just like in America, it's all about the money, not women's health.
Follow us on Twitter at Life Issues USA and stay informed, more informed than you've ever been.
Hi, I'm Mark Hawkinson with an invitation for you to join me over the weekday noon hour for Moments of Assurance, your lunchtime spiritual recipe. You'll enjoy encouraging scriptures, a bit of Bible history and trivia, news items, humor, the kids' corner, and more, all mixed in with faith-strengthening sacred music, a blend just right for your midday hour. So join me, won't you? That's Moments of Assurance over the weekday noontime hour here on Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news.
Does your church need help to discover its true mission? Hi, this is Rich Robertson, President and CEO of the Lutheran Church Extension Fund. It happens to all of us. At some point in our lives, we get distracted, confused, or maybe even burned out, and eventually we lose focus. So it's nice to know at times like these that you have a partner at LCEF. Our ministry support services can help your church clarify its mission so it enjoys sustained health and growth. Learn more at www.lcef.org.
One theft every 6.5 minutes. 156 thefts every day. Here's a shout out to the more than 57,000 drivers who admittedly made it easy for the thieves last year. 57,000 who left the keys in their vehicle and had it stolen. Lock it before you leave it. Don't make it easy for the thief. If you know something about vehicle theft or insurance fraud, call us at 1-800-TELL-NICB. A public service message from the National Insurance Crime
Think
Bureau.
Think fast. In the short time it takes to listen to this message, a small flame can turn into a big fire. Several minutes more, and thick, poisonous smoke may have filled your lungs and reduced your ability to respond. Give it 5, and your entire home may be filled with flames.
Keep breathing. We've got you.
Don't let your world go up in smoke. Have working smoke alarms and keep children 3 feet away from anything that gets hot. Learn more at usfa.fema.gov because fire is everyone's fight.
Technology is always changing, and Worldwide KFUO keeps up with the emerging broadcast and internet technology. We proclaim the gospel to the world via the radio, online, and on demand. Listen to AM 850 KFUO in St. Louis or listen to our live stream and on-demand audio at kfuo.org. Worldwide KFUO proclaims in word and song the message of mercy and forgiveness through Christ. We are Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Faith and Family.
You're listening to Faith and Family. I'm Andy Bates. Joining me by phone today, Carol Dippold, an older adult counselor with Lutheran Family and Children's Services of Missouri. Carol, welcome to Faith and Family.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to speak with you.
Carol, tell me about your work as older adult counselor for LFCS of Missouri.
Okay. We have had a program going for individuals with memory loss for about 9 years. It started with a group for individuals who at that time we were calling early memory loss, and we had been awarded a grant through the Brookdale Foundation. And we started that group up with one person, and by the end of the month we had two, and by the end of the year we had 12. So it just grew incredibly well, and it served a very good purpose for a couple years. And then, as with most dementia, the decline was noticed, and we recognized the need for a group for individuals who were in later stages. So we once again got a grant and added a group for later stage memory loss. And that one flourished very well. And again, as disease progresses, we could see where the people's conditions were progressing further along, and we needed to go back at a group for very early, because our early were each gradually going along in that spectrum. So we now have three groups, Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday, and we tend to put them into an early, middle, and late stage categories.
Why is memory care important, an important part of caring for aging adults?
You know, when I think about it, there are two ways of looking at memory care. And up until our anticipated conversation today, I've always focused on memory care for people who have or are in those beginning stages of memory loss. But I thought it might be good to bring out the importance of maintaining memory prior to that.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be for those healthy individuals who are earlier in life, before the anticipated decline in memory would occur, who do need to do everything they can to maintain healthy brains for as long as possible. And the whole idea of that is that they can maintain a better sense of confidence and be more independent and maybe allow themselves to get more creative, you know, as they're going into later years of life, as opposed to those who have now reached an early cognitive decline in later years. And here it becomes very important to maintain memory health, because we want them to maintain their independence for as long as possible. So I think that's really getting to be the bottom line, is to keep people as able to be as independent for as long as they can in making their own decisions, living as independently, continuing to drive, all safely and for as long as possible.
Why is independence such an important part of life? I know, you know, I have a 3-year-old son, so I understand that desire for autonomy. Why in our older years is that independence still so important?
I think as we have gone through life and we have had that independence, to then have it pulled out from under us or taken away from us, it just becomes such a battle often between the individual who is losing it and the person who is, in essence, in some cases, actually taking it away, saying, no, you may not drive, or no, you will not live alone anymore. But at the same time, just for that own individual sense of self-esteem and well-being, that they can, that they're thinking they're no longer worthy or capable or valuable as a person because they cannot do for themselves. So I think it's just our whole being. We want to be as independent as we can for as long as we can.
What happens? What are the consequences if we neglect a memory or cognitive issue, if we don't receive care for memory issues?
It can escalate. It's really important when an older adult who is having memory loss problems gets a good diagnosis to confirm what is causing that problem, because often it is a reversible condition. It could be that their diet is not adequate and they have a vitamin deficiency, or they may be having mini strokes, or they could have an infection. UTIs, urinary tract infections, often can impair memory. Their medications may not be working well. Even being dehydrated can be very significant in terms of thinking and cognition. So by getting that early diagnosis and getting it checked to be sure of what the cause of the memory loss is, can in some instances prevent it from getting worse. But on the other hand, where it would, through all the testing and evaluation, confirm that there is a dementia due to Alzheimer's or Lewy bodies or vascular, you know, whatever the reason might be, by getting that diagnosis early enough, there can be some interventions, I think, that will slow the progression, which is what our groups are hopefully doing. They have medications that can be administered, and these, they intend to slow it. For some people they work, for some people they do not. But there's really no cure, so we're just looking at this point yet at trying to slow the progression for people. So that would be the really important part of taking care of it, so the consequences of going further can be stopped as soon as possible.
What are some of the signs that there's a memory issue and the care is needed?
I think one of the ones that shows up often in families is individuals having difficulty with money management, and they may not be managing their checkbooks properly. They may be doing extravagant spending. They may be giving money away that they normally would not be giving to certain kinds of or certain individuals. Other than the money, there is the misplacing of items. And as you often hear and see, the keys are found in the refrigerator, or food is found in a drawer in the bathroom, or just random items are out of place, which is another important sign. I think one that can be the most threatening and scary is a loss of direction. And this can come without any forewarning, where someone is driving home and all of a sudden they realize that they don't know where they are. They may be headed totally in the opposite direction of where they want to go, and they're not even able to identify that as the situation. And that can be very scary. Often those people do get home, and they may mask it or cover it and not tell people and hope it's an isolated event. Sometimes they do not get home, but losing sense of direction would be another sign. And then we have the common ones where people forget words and names and mislabel family members. Things such as that can also be some of those warning signs.
As a family member, as a loved one, perhaps a spouse, you see these signs. Maybe you're a spouse, or you know, adult children of someone who's starting to present some of these signs of memory loss. How do you approach that conversation? How do you begin a conversation? How do you open the door to try to get help and care for someone with memory loss?
And that can be a very touchy subject. A lot will depend on the relations the individuals have in that family. It may be there would be a particular individual in that family who would be a better one to approach, mom or dad, if we're talking of a parent-child relationship. Maybe even a child as opposed to a spouse. It just could be very individual. And then that person in love would try and talk with the person with the memory loss and say, you know, that I feel concern for your safety or your well-being, or just that things are going to go well for us. And these are things that I maybe have observed. And it's so important not to be critical or judgmental or cause the person with the memory loss to become on the defensive. And as that disease progresses more and more, it's even more important to accept that person where he or she is. So in the very beginning, when there still is some reason and thinking going on in the individual with the memory loss, hopefully they can accept that as a gesture of love and want to work with the family in doing that. It sometimes is helpful to have a family meeting, and often outside individual can come in, maybe a pastor or a counselor or someone else, and sit with the family and as a group discuss things more easily than just the family trying to confront or approach the other family member with the memory loss on it. So, you know, it's like I said, it's a very difficult conversation often to have. And I think going to support groups for family members is maybe one way to help get some ideas on that, because often the people in these support groups have already been in that position of having to confront or deal with the issue and dealing it with the family. And then again, the doctor would be another option, because especially when it comes to driving, the individual with memory loss can become very guarded and defensive and not want to have to forfeit driving. And if a family member tells them that, it can create a lot of conflict. So if it comes from a doctor, the family doctor perhaps, that person may be a little bit more accepting of it. The thing with Alzheimer's and these other dementias and memory losses is it is very individual. No two scenarios are going to play out the same in any two people. So what works in one situation may not work in another situation. So each family will have to find what works better for their own situation. And sometimes it's a hit and miss and it takes time, but it is very important to address those issues with that individual.
What are the programs that Lutheran Family Children's Services of Missouri offers that can help individuals and families that are facing memory issues?
Okay. Here in Cape Girardeau, which is where we have the older adult services, we have the groups 3 days a week for individuals with the memory loss. The Monday group is now the group for people who are in the later stages. The Thursday group is for the people who are more moderate. And then the Tuesday group is for people who are very early. These individuals may be living alone, may be living with family, but are relatively independent. Perhaps they are still driving. So the Tuesday group individuals often are aware of their memory not being what it was, or their cognition and their thinking, and they will discuss it. And that's one of the features of this group, is that we do a lot of sharing and talking about what is it like when we're told we're not remembering well, or what is it like when we're told we're not to be driving anymore. So these group members share a lot of the emotional portion of what's going on with having the memory loss, or maybe they even have been given a diagnosis. Whereas on the Monday group, these people who are later stage, it's benefiting that individual to come to our groups, because I think socialization is very important, but it also is helping their loved one, be that a spouse or an adult child who is responsible for the care of their parent, because that person who is involved in now 24-hour care, because that's the progression that we're seeing, needs a break. And so this group not only is giving the care receiver, the person with the memory loss, time to socialize and be with other people and do some very structured activities, but it is also benefiting the caregiver by giving that person 4 hours to do whatever he or she needs or wants to do for him or herself, which is so very important. And the Thursday group is kind of a middle of the two of those. Some of those individuals are going toward that later stage, and they do have a more intense respite need for their care providers, whereas there are others in the group yet who are a little bit earlier on, and it's not meeting any critical need yet for a care provider. So those groups, the early, middle, and later stage groups, are one service that we have to offer. Another one that we offer is the support group for family caregivers. And this meets on the second Monday of the month, and it is about an hour and a half long. And we do this through the Alzheimer's Association, which provides us with a lot of literature and information that we can share with family members. But these family members, they come together, they share their experiences, their frustrations, ways that they have found to try and solve or address different problems that might come up. And it's through that sharing and personal expression of frustrations or joys or whatever it is that they build a really strong core among themselves and find a lot of good support. We have many who come and say they didn't realize how many other people were having these same kinds of problems that they were having to live with. And just knowing that there is another person out there dealing with these things. And then sometimes they'll call each other between times. But that kind of camaraderie and fellowship that they can share is another way that we help to serve as the support group. And then between support groups and the individuals who are coming to the groups for individuals with memory loss, we do one-on-one consultation and meet with families and offer counseling in terms of things that we think might help in any kind of situation that they're facing. We might have some informational literature that we can discuss and share with them in terms of specific care techniques and things like that. So it's the support for families and consulting, and it's the support group for the caregivers as a group, and then it's the groups for the individuals themselves.
Let's talk about some activities, ways to keep our memories, our cognitive abilities strong, even perhaps before there might be any signs of a memory issue.
Okay. And as I had alluded to a little earlier, I'm thinking, again, along two veins. I'm thinking of those people who are really well, they're maybe still in the workforce, and they just want to do everything they can to do whatever they can to prevent maybe going the direction of dementia, the way we're seeing it in the growing older adult population. And it's interesting, the number of books now that one can find that actually have techniques and strategies for doing this. And this is not an area that I spend a lot of time with because I'm typically working with the older adults who have more advanced memory loss. But there are techniques available and organizational methods and phonetics and acronyms and rehearsal and planning, different techniques as those, that those individuals who are earlier on, prior to any kind of memory loss, could use. But then someone who is already having memory loss, and they may be, you know, close to or already having been given a diagnosis of dementia, of Alzheimer's or Lewy body, or many other forms of dementia, at this time, we're no longer looking at those same preventive learned techniques, I don't feel. I think now we're looking at more how can we help this person to maintain their level of independence and living for as long as they still can. And here I think it's so important to, one, socialize. Often we see individuals, once they have been given a diagnosis or they feel they're having memory loss, they become very uncomfortable being in a situation or an environment with other people, so they withdraw and isolate themselves, which is probably one of the worst things we can do to keep our minds alert and active. So by socializing, I think that is a very important key to helping one keep their minds going and their memories as alert as possible. Diet is also important, and that's one of those things that would also come into the earlier stages, but even throughout time, we want to be eating what they say a heart healthy diet is a brain healthy diet. So getting away from processed foods, fatty foods that aren't like the omega-3 type foods, green vegetables, just all these things we can do to keep our diets as healthy as possible. And at the very top of the list on all that is exercise, because with that good blood flow and oxygen intake, we are going to be helping our brains to keep going as positively for as long as possible. So I think those are some key concepts. As far as specific activities, a lot of times in our groups, people talk about doing the Sudokus or the crosswords or word searches. Any of these kinds of activities is good. The idea is to add variety and not to do the same kinds of activities over and over. So we encourage a lot of different
activities in our groups. I do exercises with sequencing. I think it's important to try and help people retain the ability to put things in the right order. That is one of the things that becomes lost as a dementia progresses. A person may not remember what order to put their clothes on or what progression or steps they need to take in brushing their teeth, for example. So trying to maintain an order for them. So that would be like a sequencing kind of thing. We do things with words very often. I will give a brief sentence or a description of a concept or an object, and then they have to provide the word that would explain it. And it's really fascinating, and again, this is so very individual, but it's so very fascinating how where one individual can be very quick on the verbal, another one might be very quick with spatial, another one might have good memory recall of general knowledge. Everyone is individual, but as many of these different activities that a person can work on their own, I think is really helpful.
So there certainly are some things that we can do now before even any potential signs of a memory loss. What?
Yes.
How can loved ones find a memory care program in their area if they, you know, if you have a spouse or a parent that you think is experiencing some memory loss? What is the first step? I would assume perhaps contacting a physician, maybe getting an appointment. And where do we go from there? How do we find help?
I think getting that contact with the physician is very important. From my own experience, many of the physicians really don't have a good sense of direction beyond a diagnosis of where they can reach out to help. The Alzheimer's Association is a good provider of resources and literature, and they may know of a support group or of a memory group or an adult day type program that could accept someone with memory loss. More specifically, I would reflect back to the Brookdale Foundation, which is what granted all our startup funds, and they have granted that throughout the nation to different agencies and organizations, and they have a list of where all of their adult day programs are that they have helped to initiate. So that would be a resource. That's the Brookdale Foundation. Also, the Area Agencies on Aging. Now, in our Cape Girardeau area, that is now called Aging Matters, but they have information also for older adults, and often it would include information on adult daycare programs or adult memory programs. And perhaps also the hospitals. I've known of a couple hospitals, at least, who have within their organizations are initiating adult day memory programs. So the hospitals might also be a contact.
Very good. Well, this is certainly helpful information, and I certainly appreciate it. Anything else as we wrap up our conversation today, Carol?
Oh, I just really appreciate the time, and if anyone would need help with that and want to contact me, I'd be happy to help them too through our agency.
Very good. How can we find out more about Lutheran Family and Children's Services of Missouri to get answers for questions like that?
Okay, yes. You can contact me, Carol D., at lfcs.org, or go to our website, www.lfsmo.org. I'm sorry, lfcsmo.org.
lfcsmo.org.
Yes.
It's Lutheran and Family Children's Services of Missouri, and find out more about memory care. Carol, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for this helpful information, and perhaps we've helped some listeners today as well.
I surely hope so. Thank you very much.
Listen to Faith and Family Monday through Friday at this time. Faith and Family is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for Faith and Family to continue. Our address is 1333 South Kirkwood Road, St. Louis, Missouri, 63122. You can contact us on the web and download Faith and Family at kfuo.org. Worldwide KFUO, on the air, online, and on demand.